So, dear bodhisattvas, yes, all of us here are bodhisattvas. We may not think we're bodhisattvas, but we are. Because all of us have taken the big step to look at what it is that drives us, what it is that makes us yearn for what is not here, that makes us angry for what is here, that makes us sad and frustrated at our lives. So we've spent this time, however amount of time you've spent here, a day, a week, a month, stopping those thoughts that drive us, around in circles, rokudo, over and over, stopping and just looking at them, just seeing them, being curious. What is this? What is this huge reaction to someone's frown or smile? What is that? Just to see. We have confidence that if we stop being driven and just see, change will come. Yuan Mei, a poet from China, late Chinese, 18th century, wrote a poem on the road to Tiantai. You know, Tiantai is the holiest mountain in China. It is often stands for samadhi or strength of practice. It's the home of Tendai Buddhism, out of which came Zen. Much of, particularly Japanese Zen, is very influenced by Tendai Buddhism that started on Mount Tiantai. So, on the road to Mount Tiantai, already the title gives us something. Huh? Wrapped, surrounded by 10,000 mountains, cut off, no place to go. Until you're here, there's no way to get here. Once you're here, there's no way to go. So, wrapped and surrounded by 10,000 mountains, cut off, no place to go. Until you're here, there's no way to get here. Once you're here, there's no way to go. Thousand years before, Li Po wrote, "We sit together, the mountain and me, and until only the mountain remains." What did he mean? All that which drives him had dropped away until he could be truly present to mountain. And so this more modern man, in writing in the 1750s, experienced the same quality of being wrapped and surrounded by mountain. No difference between him and the mountain. No place to go. Why no place to go? When you're a hawk, like the hawks that come around here and whistle in the afternoons, they have no place to go. Because they're everywhere, flying through the sky, not leaving a trace. Once you're here, there's no way to go. That recalls Shinryu's comments about the path. When he read the Machado poem, not looking for the way that you are. So those of us who are here today, right now, have consciously or unconsciously taken the Bodhisattva vow. The vow to wake up. And in that waking up, to live a more sane and compassionate life. Thus making it possible for others to wake up. If we're driving everyone around us crazy, they're not going to be able to wake up either. Huh? It's a kind of indirect social action. The Avatamsaka Sutra says, sentient beings are those beings that are overwhelmed in the sea of samsara, drowning in the sea of samsara. Those beings who cannot see how their thoughts, their karmic inheritance, are driving them. And so they helplessly create more unskillful karma out of their suffering. No way to get out of their suffering. So that's why we bodhisattvas go on retreat. Not to stay on retreat, not that there's something perfect about retreat, but to gain insight, to see ourselves as we are, to see an aspect of our being that is not so heavily conditioned, such a result of our conditioning. Of the karma we inherited from our family, our country, our world. We have no control over that karma that we have inherited. What we have control over is the karma we produce and how we understand that inheritance, how we learn forgiveness, understanding, compassion. Here's what Saicho wrote about the 10th century in Japan. Those who won't discard all attachments to this world and accept this life are doomed to return like gold, to die again and again. Let me read it to you again. Those who won't discard all attachments to this world and accept this life are doomed to return like gold, to die again and again. If we don't loosen our grip on our grasping, that's what he's saying. When he says don't discard, those who don't discard their attachments, he's talking about those who fail to recognize that our attachment, that our grasping, or our pushing away, separating ourselves, are unskillful ways, and they doom us to, like gold, you know, gold is constantly remelted and made into something else and made into something else and made into something else. And we're doomed to make this same pot of stew over and over and over again. Now, on one level, of course, it's about the transmigration, because that was a belief system at that time. But on another level, this Rokudo, this movement from being a god to being a human, to being a fighting titan, to being an animal, to being a hungry ghost, to being a demon of hell, can be seen within a minute and a half of your zazen. You sit there like a god. And then the stomach growls and you remember, I'm human. But I can wait. I have consciousness. And then the vicious, fierce titan comes up and say, what the hell? The schedule, it's crazy. I don't. They're starving me to death. Animal nature comes out. Hungry ghost, give me, I just want some, please, give me, I can never get enough. And the hell demons, I can't even imagine right now what that might be like. But I think each of you know intimately what a hell demon can be like. And then the bell rings. And the God returns. Rokudo, the endless transmigration of our energies. Those who won't discard all attachments to this world and accept this life are doomed to return like gold, to die again and again and again. So what would stop that transmigration? What would stop that? To see it, to recognize it. Oh, there I go again. And can we just accept that? There I go again. As an aspect of what it is, because in fact we are humans. And we are vulnerable to this constant transmigration. In the act of acceptance, it loses its bite on us. It doesn't mean it doesn't happen, but we don't believe it anymore. It's still happening, but I don't believe it. Huge difference. Huge difference. You're not helpless. You're not a victim. And you begin to realize that you're part of this interconnected reality, that possibly you're not sitting alone in the room having these thoughts. Perhaps you're part of a larger body. Realizing this, you begin to have understanding and compassion for the delusion of others. Maybe starting with loved ones, people close, and then extending out. Oh, she's caught up in her dream. Oh, he's an angry titan right now. How could I reflect in a way so he could see that? This ceaseless change is always occurring in our minds. And when we're on retreat, we can see it in simple ways. If we think we have an unchanging pain in our knee, we stop for a moment and pay close attention to that knee. Pay close attention. We discover that actually it's changing all the time. It is not this black box here of pain, but actually there are little movements here and there and sensations that go in different directions. And as we see that, we recognize that and pay attention to it, most of the time, I'm not saying the pain goes away, because it doesn't, but there is a relaxing of the tension in the area. There is an easing, and we recognize more change. And if we pay close attention, we can recognize those changes in ourselves, in our moods, in our attitudes. We don't have to see everything the same way in each moment. We learn not to run away from our pain, we learn to look carefully, to pay attention to our pain. We studied the Genjo Koan last spring. Dogen says, when you practice intimately and return to where you are, it will be clear that nothing at all has an unchanging self. It couldn't be more clear, more said more directly. When we pay attention to whatever suffering we have, whether we're depressed, we're angry, or our knee hurts, pay close attention and you will see the flow, the changing nature of everything. And through that, we develop a willingness to work with whatever comes up in our life, which is another way of saying accepting our life as it is. Which doesn't mean we don't work for change, but change only really happens when you truly accept where you are in the moment. And we become curious about what's keeping us from accepting it. Even our sadness, our depression, look at it carefully. It's not, again, not a black box. It has its changes, its movements, its subtleties of form. Kino Tsuraki was not a Zen poet. He was before Zen came to Japan, very early 9th century. He wrote this about this unchanging nature of the self. Approaching midnight on a hillside in springtime in a temple hall, even in my deepest dreams, the blossoms continue to fall. He recognizes that no matter where he is or what time it is, all is as impermanent as blossoms that continue to fall. If you've ever been in a bit of a wind, when there are cherry blossoms or apple blossoms or pear blossoms, and suddenly the whole sky is filled with the color of that blossoms as they fall off the tree. And of course, Japan is particularly noted for its cherry blossoms and for the poetry that has evolved out of the idea of blossoms falling. If we could accept that quality in our life, that unchanging, that sense that everything is constantly changing, constantly moving, constantly shifting, we would lose this, particularly the hungry ghost quality of our nature, that which is always grasping, which can create the Titan and the hell demon. Because we want, we want, we want. Let it go like the tree lets the blossom fall off. And if we're really alert, we can see how our masks, our personal individual masks, are ways that we have of pulling away from others, of blaming others, or blaming ourselves. And we can stop for a moment, congratulate ourselves, oh, I've stopped. I've seen it. I'm wearing the mask of failure. I'm wearing the mask of blaming. It's all your fault. Oh, over and over again, when people come to me to talk about their meditation practice, it's usually a series of complaints. And I always try to emphasize over and over again, those of you who've been around for a while have certainly heard this before, but isn't it wonderful that you recognize what you're doing with your mind? And wouldn't it be interesting that the next time you notice how you're not doing what you think you should be doing, you could just say, "Hey, I noticed." And it could be like, you know, terrific. Instead of, "Oh, I'm no good at this." You know, you noticed. So, because the second thought, "Oh, I'm no good at this," is just part of another habitual, unceasing thought wave. We can wake up. That's what we're here to do. So today is our last full day of Sesshin. And it's natural that in some part of our minds is the idea of what happens when we go home to our families, to our single rooms, to our work, to our commitments. How might they be different after Sesshin? When you practice intimately and return to where you are, it will be clear that nothing at all has unchanging self. So I look around the room and what do I see? Everyone's face has changed. The masks have slipped off. The faces are relaxed and open. Without the tics and the tension that we usually carry. Before you leave, there's a place to pick up your masks at the door. They're hanging there for when you need them. They're not really masks, of course. They're the fears and tensions of not being able to accept the situation, the self of the moment. Our inability to accept the natural pain that arises as a result of being alive. And so we put on the mask, and then we don't flow. We become static. We don't respond naturally to what's in front of us. We're scared. Baizang, Yakujo, great master in China, wrote, "If you want to gather pearls, you must first calm the waters. When the water is moving, it's difficult to look for pearls. The water of samadhi is clean and transparent and reveals the pearl of the mind of its own accord." We have stopped here and revealed our minds. Even if you think, "Oh, everyone else did, but I didn't," you did. You just don't remember it because you were in samadhi. You can't remember it because you weren't there. It's important to try not now to make your experience of this session into some kind of special thing, to not try to hold on to it. Your idea of Sesshin, your idea of practice. Just as it's important not to hold on to your idea of your life, where you're going back to, it's important to let go of any fixed notion of what has happened here. Because then holding is like a stasis. It is not reality. very easy for us to get stuck on some idea of ourselves, and it's so limiting. I mean, you can't be alive in the situation. There's a great story I read the other day in Dogen Shobo Genzo. Actually, he's talking about it in terms of liturgy, in terms of ritual, but I think it works really well for the idea of being careful not to hold on to some idea of your experience of Sesshin, which is what I'm really trying to get across today. A monk was always carrying around with great reverence this box in which he had a golden image of the Buddha and some other relics. And even in the sleeping hall and the zazen hall, he would burn incense and, you know, mutter to his box of special relics. And one day the Zen master said, that image and those relics will be no use to you later on. And the monk said, oh, these are my images, and I'm holding them. And the master said, they're just demons. You've got to get rid of them now. And the monk grabbed them, and he was angry, and he started to walk away from the teacher. And the teacher said, open the box and look inside. And the monk stopped, and he looked into the box, and there was a poisonous snake coiled, ready to bite him. Poisonous snake, something so beautiful, like a golden relic of the Buddha, can be turned into a poisonous snake. So your idea of the purity and joy of Sesshin, or your experience of the Sesshin, when you go back to the city, could turn into a poisonous snake for you. Sesshin good, my life no good. Or my practice no good, me no good. Or only in retreat can I practice. Locked in a box, the snake poisons the mind, poisons our hearts. This is my favorite cup because of this little imperfection here. I love it. So I want to tell you one more story. It's a cow story, another cow story. This one, a reverse perspective. The one I told last week or earlier in the week was about releasing the cows. This is about a man. By the way, this is from the 100 Parable Sutra that Kaz Ta-Nehisi translated with Peter Levitt in a book called Flock of Fools, and it's 100 parables about foolish practitioners. And this one is about a man who had a beautiful herd of 250 cows. And it might be good for you to realize that there are 250 precepts in the old tradition. Not in our tradition, but in the Theravadan tradition. So he had a beautiful herd of 250 cows, and he loved them so much. He cared for them really well. He loved to comb them down. He fed them nice grain, and they just were beautiful fat cows. And he took a lot of pleasure in taking them out to pasture and fresh water. But one day, a tiger got one of the cows and killed it. And the man thought, since I've lost a cow, my herd is no longer complete. What use are all these other cows? So he drove them off a cliff and killed them all. So the commentary focuses on the 250 Buddhist precepts and reminds us that when we break one precept, we shouldn't give up and break them all. better to repair our karma for the one. So here in Sesshin, we don't have to make decisions like latte or zazen, pornography or poetry, TV or Zen study. We don't have to make those decisions, but starting tomorrow, we're going to begin to have to make those kind of decisions again. Please don't give up if you break a precept or an idea you might have of how you're going to behave when you get back. When I get back, throwing away all of my things that harm me, and I'm just going to have a zafu in my room and nothing else. Throw out my liquor cabinet. Just observe what arises. Don't kill all the other cows. Because our practice is not about us, really. It's not really all about us. It's about how we can serve and care for others. So how tragic it would be that because we break one precept or one idea of how we should behave, we stop taking care of ourselves so that we can take care of others. Oh, if we lose a cow, take care of the other 249. This principle, you know, is well known in addiction circles. Falling off and not getting back on. Apparently, I just read that Oprah's magazine had a picture on the front of her when she had lost all that weight and she was very thin, and then another picture side by side of her now that she weighs 200 pounds. And the article talks about how when she realized that she was gaining weight, she just gave up and let it go and didn't think about it and didn't weigh herself and fired her trainer. And we really see this in so many ways in practice, in our own lives. Each of us can think of it, a way in which we drive all the cows off the cliff. We give up, we lose faith in ourselves. I urge you not to do that in terms. You have had an opportunity to wake up. When you lose a cow, be curious about it. Take a look at it. Work with it. It's beautiful material for your practice. It's not to numb out, to just forget about it. You know, I think we've all done this in our zazen. You're sitting in zazen and you suddenly wake up for a moment. You realize that you've been daydreaming. And then you go, well, I've 20 minutes in, I might as well daydream the next 15. In a daze, in a doze, in a frenzy, it's all the same. Waking up. We have action again. We have agency again. You know, in the martial arts, 7 times knock down, 8 times get up. That's just our life, really. And it's such a gift when we exercise that perseverance to know we're not perfect and not likely to be. And still keep practicing, still keep getting up, still practicing. And certainly I have learned that in my life relationships, it's when I slip up and I'm willing to meet that place where I have lost a cow, and to own it. And to look deeply at it. What caused me to lose that cow? What caused me to say that unskillful thing to someone? And then to go to that person and to express that. That's intimacy. That's love. And it's very different from all the perfection and protection and defensiveness that we try to have. And perfection was a good word to say there too, because it's all about trying to be perfect and look perfect. But when we really open ourselves, there's such a love that can develop. Last night, I'm not real crazy about pets. I have some opinions about pets, particularly because I live in downtown New York, and I have some opinions about people who have pets in downtown New York. And last night there was this thunderstorm, and I'm sort of kind of taking care of Scout, and she doesn't like thunder. And so, you know, I woke up with this this dog on the other side of the pillow. I mean, we had arranged things so she was on the floor and I was in the bed, you know, and that was our negotiated deal. But not last night. And you know, the tenderest feelings that I had, because she was so vulnerable and scared. You know, and I'm like, it's okay. And all day long, I've been experiencing this wonderful tenderness toward her and a kind of softening feeling. And that's what happens all the time when we reveal ourselves to others. We give them that opportunity. When we're willing to see what our stuff is and be aware of our karmic inheritance and what happens, and then we share it with another, then it just grows. It's the most amazing thing. Just like Scout did, by being frightened and willing to share her fear with me. You know, she affected me in a profound way today. It's very sweet. So, my encouragement for you is to find the supports for your practice as you go back into your ordinary lives. My whole life is devoted to a practice that occurs, essentially a lay practice, that occurs in the midst of people's lives, in the midst of work and relationship. It's very important to me. It's great for us to have retreats, but when it really matters is when we go back to our homes. So I just want to remind you of the five expressions that I developed as a way for you to maintain and support your practice. First of all, meditate. Please do that a half an hour every day without fail. Just do that. Just do it. Study a little bit, a piece of a verse. You know, get one of those things online, this little thought of the day, tricycle thoughts of the day, or Shambhala thoughts of the day. We have a reading list. You know, after you've practiced here for a few years, you should have read all the books on the reading list. Be good for you. Come to the Ox series we have. We have other kinds of study series. Those are, we don't do those just because it's fun. It's a lot of work. We do them so that you have an opportunity to really dig into the study aspect of the practice. Communicate. Three is communicate or express. Don't hold it in. Creatively express it. Express your feelings. Allow yourself to be a part of the world. Don't hold back. Let it out. Four, act. When we don't act, our connection with things becomes numbed. If you care about health care for the poor, I hope that you have written a letter, that you have sent an email, that you have called the congresspeople in your district, even though you know that you live in liberal New York or Massachusetts, and fine, still, it changes you and it changes them. If you're just part of the mass that says, oh, this is terrible, oh, terrible, you don't feel any agency, you don't feel any strength, you're not able to talk about it. if you care that Aung San Suu, whatever her last name is in prison, you should have written letters to the Thai embassy. You should have. You must do that. That's act. Don't just sit back. Act. It's terribly important. And the final one is caring, taking stewardship and responsibility of your resources, taking care of yourself and your family and your community. So that really means paying your bills, not going into debt, giving generously to those in need, starting with yourself. So that's the way I think we can release our cows without holding or care for the cows that we have. Those are ways for us to heighten our kindness, our generosity, our compassion, so that we can find the joy and ease that Anraku talked about, the dignity and courage that Shinryu evoked in his description of Olivia, and the play and delight that Sensei brought us yesterday. We've been listening to cicadas singing outside the windows all week. Basho wrote about their acceptance of their life. Nothing in the cry of cicadas suggests that they are about to die.